Hey everybody, Spencer here. I just wanted to apologize for the clicking coming from John's microphone. I didn't hear it during the recording and didn't find it until editing, but we have resolved it for next week, so I apologize for that. I'm really happy to have John and Seth on board. So enjoy this week's episode of the show, and we'll fix that for next week. Of constructive criticism. I'm your host, Spencer, and I am joined by my co-hosts. My new co-hosts, Seth Manfield and John Stern. Just to be clear, Seth and John, this is also an audio podcast, so that you do need to talk when you make hand gestures.
Oh, we can't just wave. Hello, everyone.
How's it going, guys?
Pretty good. I mean, I just got back from the Pro Tour a few hours ago, so a little bit jet lagged, but I'm pretty excited to be for the three of us to be doing our first podcast together.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. You know what else is exciting is our sponsors at Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 15% off of your first order by using the code CCMTG at checkout. And you can get 4% off of every order by using the code WouldThatBeGood. It's super awesome. I mean, you really can't beat the prices on 15% off your first order. We've had people buy modern decks, legacy decks with that code. So check them out at Oasis Games, SLC.com. You can check out our other sponsor at Ink Gaming. Use the code CCMTG10 at checkout. They'll give us a little bit of a kickback. It'll help us get John a new mic so that you can't hear us clicking, stuff like that. So we really appreciate both of our sponsors, and they mean a lot to us. Today we're going to be talking about the Pro Tour that Seth and John just came back from. We're going to dive deep into the deck that did the best at the Pro Tour, maybe talk a little bit about what these guys played, and then kind of some other stuff overall. Before we do that, though, if you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so by going to patreon.com/ccmtg and becoming a patron of the show. And when you do that, you get to submit questions for our hashtag always improving segment. Hashtag always improving is the point of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse, and we want to do what we can all the time to improve ourselves. I mean, obviously, now I'm surrounded by people that are just really good at Magic, so hopefully they have a ton of room to improve too and can share those insights as they get better as well. This week, our question says, recently, I've been losing in top 8 of PPDQs a lot. In the past, I was often able to win a PPDQ every season. The last two seasons, however, I have found myself getting tired and bored during the event, and it's been hard to keep my focus. Is there anything that I can do during top 8s to help me keep my focus and start winning again? Why don't we start with you, Seth?
Well, I think it's one of those things playing Magic where once you find yourself reaching a certain level of comfort, maybe it's like midway through a day one of a Grand Prix for me, I'm not out there playing PPCQs, but it's still, I can use the same sorts of info. Sometimes it's just something that I'm doing a lot, and so my brain kind of can shut off momentarily, or I can just have a lapse in judgment at a moment, and it's easy to do that, and when I do it, it sucks because it's one of those things where you can reflect on it and you're like, you know, obviously you want to be giving it your 100% as often as you possibly can. And for me, just kind of staying fresh. You don't want to enter a tournament that you're not able to give your 100% to. And whether like everyone is, it's going to be something different. It could just be grabbing a snack or bringing a drink of water, or look, once you get into the top 8 itself specifically, I like to have a general idea of what my opponents are playing, who my opponents are. You can kind of dissect a little bit more the matchup, whereas if in a Swiss round setting, you're just playing against a random player, so that's right. A little bit different.
Yeah. Any thoughts on this one, John?
Yeah, I think, so just from observing like Seth in tournaments, as the tournament gets closer to the end, I've seen like his focus and stress about the event, it increases. Whereas I think a lot of people, and myself included, we have this sort of a mental letdown when we've accomplished something that we think is good, or like, oh, I got my 3 pro points, so no matter what happens, I'm going to be happy with my result. Yeah. So I think that is a way of keeping your focus, and by just making sure that you don't focus on an interim goal, focus on what you really want to achieve. And even if you don't make it, still focusing on that goal will help. So the question, the way it was phrased, I think also there were two parts to it. There was one is, why am I losing? And one is, how do I keep my focus? And to answer the question on why you're losing in top eights is a lot more difficult to dissect. But one thing that can happen at sort of a PDQ level event is that you might be choosing a deck that is really good against the field, but is maybe going to face a tough matchup at the end of the tournament where you have to win your, you know, your quarterfinals, semifinals. You have to go 3-0 at the end of the tournament. So you need to be playing a deck that's not going to have really unfavorable matchups against the best decks rather than just against the field in general. And that might mean you make top eight a little less often, but you'll be well positioned when you do. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there could also be other variables involved that we don't know about
right.
in a specific circumstance. Like maybe the field of these particular PPTQs has either grown in size, or it's become more complicated, or the format has changed. So there's other things that we may not know about in this particular instance.
Yeah, I'd like to cover kind of something that you both kind of touched on, which is that focus on different parts of tournaments, because when you think about something like a PPDQ, right? Or I really like what John said. I know for me, I have a really high number of 1 and 2 point pro point finishes at Grand Prix compared to my friends who get like more caches and 3 point finishes and have very few like 1 point finishes. And I actually do think it's because they don't care about 1 point finishes. And like, I just want to just win every match in front of me. And there's this thing that I think that happens at PPTQs specifically, I've noticed it in my time playing them, which is that the top eight doesn't mean anything. And what happens is you start to separate yourself from that to the point where the entire event is boring if you don't win, because let's be honest, PPTQs are kind of boring. And I think that the advice that I would give this specific person is just, You're going to this PPTQ to win the PPTQ. You're not going to top eight. You're not going to get some booster packs, right? It's a pretty poor use of your time, and it sounds like the winning is the most important thing to you. And I would remember that going into the event, throughout the event, is that, you know, that 3-1 start, or that 4-1 start, or that 5-0 start, right? That's just a beginning to an end, right? The end is that you want to win that PPTQ, and you kind of have to remember that throughout the whole event, because those events are not fun.
Okay. I have something to add to that, so winning a tournament that, I don't know how big these PTQs are, PPTQs are, but you know, 20 or 30 person tournament, even if you're one of the best, you know, few people in the room, is still, you're going to lose more than you win.
Yeah.
And when you set that goal and that's your only goal and everything else is bad and it's a miserable experience, you're putting yourself in a position where you're going to condition yourself for failure. And you're going to be, oh, well, I'm going to lose again. Let's just get it over with as soon as possible. And that's not the mentality you want to have when you're trying to find, you know, your 10% out to win a certain game. So I think also what Seth said is like, you don't have to play every tournament. If there's a particular store where you're not going to enjoy yourself, you know, it's not like the grind can really wear on you if you're like playing a lot of events you don't want to play. And you might actually find it's easier to keep your focus when you're going to a tournament where you're like, well rested and you're motivated to play the deck you're playing, and you know, you've put in some preparation time, and like, even if that means skipping some tournaments, that might be better for you overall.
I agree with John. I like, even if I were to go to my local FNM, that doesn't mean I'm automatically going to win.
Sure.
You don't want to think about a tournament where, well, I want to go to my PPTQ because I just want a free win. I can just go there and I can win, and I don't really need to think about it. Regardless of the tournament, of the level of tournament, you have to put in the preparation, the work, and made, like, if you were winning before, something has probably changed,
right?
Or you can just attribute it to luck, but for sure, just like if you're changing something, or maybe you feel that you're getting bored of the tournaments, that's not great. You want to be having fun at these events. You want to be enjoying them. Maybe it's just playing a deck. Like sometimes even like at the last Pro Tour, which maybe we'll get into, I was playing a deck that I actually enjoyed playing.
Right.
I knew it probably wasn't the best deck, but I knew that I would be able to focus on it, play my best Magic with it. And so maybe it's making a different deck choice. There's just kind of fiddle around with your preparation and your approach to these events is would be my suggestion.
And that's advice that we've tried to give on this podcast before, is just trying to make PPTQs fun again, because the grind is real in qualifying for the Pro Tour right now. So trying to have fun again, if you're not enjoying yourself, that's another way that you could lose focus. So
I guess I have one thing to add, which is that if you're looking for just a quick tip that's not sort of like an overarching change in your mental approach, I think it's very difficult to sort of increase your mental focus and then let it drop and then increase it. And that one way to keep it sort of high the whole tournament is to always have like a small card game, whether it's Love Letter, I Play Hanabi. You can bring like a two fast modern decks that you want to test, and just do things that engage your brain when you're on break, rather than just sit there and watch the clock. And that might help you not get tired and bored so easily.
Yeah, there's lots of really fun out of the box party games that I see players bringing to tournaments, and it's a really good time. Well, let's move on from the question, and let's talk really quickly about this podcast just for a second. I just want to welcome these guys. I wanted to get the Patreon question done, but I also just want to kind of take stock as to what's happening here. So it's week one of this new podcast. We're really excited about it. And I just wanted to give, during hashtag always improving this week, I just wanted to give everybody a chance to kind of talk about who they are, why they're doing the show, and what the show is about for them, and how they hope to help people improve at Magic going forward, because that's the point of this podcast. So why don't we start with myself? So for those who don't know, who are new to the show, welcome. My name is Spencer Howland. I'll be the host of the podcast, just like in the past. But I'm a Magic player from Utah. I've qualified for the one Pro Tour myself, kind of a PTQ grinder of the past. And I've two-time state champion. And I'm honestly just here to learn from these guys at this point. You know, my job here is to host this podcast and to give Seth and John a platform to really help Magic players improve. And that's including myself now. And I'm really excited about it. John, you are... Are you gold still? I actually don't know how the system works
right now. I'm right. As of today, I'm gold.
So why don't you talk about who you are and what you're doing here? Yeah.
Well, I've been playing Magic, since I guess I started in Revised. I've been playing on the PT. I took breaks for school and for work at various times, but I think my first PT was 2000, Chicago 2000. Most recently on this recent stint, I started playing again beginning of 2012, and I've been on the PT since then, mostly gold for that time. I'm... still studying this game. So yeah. In terms of what I want to get out of the podcast, when I think about Magic, I think a lot about theory, and a lot of it is preparation theory, but not just like how to improve a deck, but how someone might get better at whatever task they're trying to do, and how you can organize, people to work alongside you to achieve these goals. And I thought, the approach of your podcast is really interesting. It would help me, I think a lot of people, I've mentioned this before, they just try to get better in order to win the next tournament. But I think that's a very different task than getting better at Magic in general. And I think having this constant content where we're trying to help people improve their game, as opposed to just fine tuning a deck list, will help me focus on that. And that's what I'm interested in.
Awesome. Well, first of all, your swords in the background are really cool, John, but they're not quite as cool as the trophies behind Seth Manfield. Seth, how's it going? Welcome.
Hey, guys. Yeah, happy to be here. This is my first time being a part of a podcast in this sort of capacity. I'm super excited. It's been something I've kind of been thinking about, but I've never really had the right opportunity to get involved with podcasting. I am a Magic coach, and I do my own writing on the side, as well as being a professional player. If you're familiar with Grand Prix and Pro Tours and you're watching that that type of stuff, you'll probably will be familiar with my name. But I like to talk about myself beyond my accomplishments and my resume, and the idea of being able to help other players, even at, you know, various levels. It doesn't have to be, well, it's probably not in most cases the level that I'm currently at. So I'd like to be able to see if I can I'd like to give back and approach Magic in a different way, and maybe explain how players who are at the PPTQ or even at an FNM level can just kind of enjoy playing Magic, maybe win a bit more. And I like talking about Magic, which I don't really have a great way to verbalize some of my opinions other than in written form. And I think this is a great way to do that.
Well, we're excited to have you. Also, congratulations on your Hall of Fame weekend. I hope that it was amazing, because that's the pinnacle, Seth. So congratulations, man.
Thank you. Yeah, I've gotten quite a bit of feedback about that. For those who are unaware, I was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and that happened just very recently at the Pro Tour in Atlanta. And yeah, it was a bit emotional for me to actually physically be inducted, and I did get a little bit emotional because Magic just means that much to me, and it's been something I've been playing for so long, been working towards, and been putting so much of my time into, and it was just kind of this culmination of everything adding up there. And so feel free to watch the speech. I've heard tons of different opinions on it, but what I can guarantee to you guys is I'm just going to be myself. I'm not going to try to put on some face or be someone that I'm not. So that I can for sure say, you can trust me on that.
Well, we're excited to have both of you here. Thank you so much. It's been a couple months coming, and we're finally here. So hopefully, as we do the show, hashtag always improving will be here to stay. Just like John and Seth have said, this is the goal of the show. You know, there's a constructed focus on this podcast, right? Like, we want to be helping you get better at constructed. And a large part of that is because that's the way most people are going to qualify for the Pro Tour. That's how they're going to achieve a lot of their Magic goals. And you know, the training grounds will be here to help across all of Magic. But we're really excited to keep always improving being our focus. And speaking of that, let's get into this week's deck of the week, speaking of constructed. And today I want to talk about the white aggro decks that did well at the Pro Tour. So I'm going to use this opportunity really quick to talk a little bit about the Pro Tour. So Seth and John, we do a power ranking segment typically on this show. And we're not going to do a full power ranking segment this week, just because sometimes the Pro Tour data is a little bit harder to use. But I did go ahead and do a power rankings this week, and I gave decks 3 points for 27 to 30 points, 2 points just below that, and then 18 to 20, they got 1 point. And the way that this broke down is Jeskai Control came in with 27 points, Mono Red and Drakes came in with 35, Green Black Midrange came in with 55, and White Aggro came in with 56. So white aggro did the best at the Pro Tour in multiple places too. White Weenie had the highest day two percentage of decks over a certain amount as well. So this deck really was the deck of the tournament, Seth.
Oh, it was. Yeah. I mean, look at the top eight. I believe there was six copies of basically white aggro. And then I believe the top four was, at least the finals we know, was definitely two different white aggro decks. Now, there were different versions of the deck, and there were very mixed results from like, for instance, we look at the deck that LSV played, which is kind of the most innovative version of the deck because it relies on the life gain element. But I believe that his Pro Tour team only finished about 49 and about even with the deck overall, even though he did really well. A lot of his teammates didn't.
Yeah, they, so, he said 44% win percentage for the team on that deck.
44%. So we have to look at a lot of different data points on this. We saw how his deck operated in the top eight itself, and it appeared that he was favored in those white mirrors, but I believe that they may have been giving up some percentage points against black-green at the same time. So it's hard to say, is that actually the best version of White Weenie? That may be very much a metagame call. And then we're looking at the heroic reinforcements versus more of the tokens version versus Venerated Luxon. What's your big play in the deck? And I think that even though we know, okay, this Benelish Marshall card is great, History of Benalia, the various two drops like Adanto Vanguard is great. So we know that there's this core part of the deck that's base white that is very powerful. It's still kind of unclear to me if there's like a so-called best version of this deck because there's a number of different versions. And it's also very weird to me because while there were six copies in the top eight, I'm not confident that this is like a red-black chain whirler type thing where it's just going to be a dominant deck moving forward, because there were a lot of other strategies that did pretty well. Like I practiced against this deck leading up to the Pro Tour. It was impossible to ignore. It crushed the mocks. And I felt like the deck that I played and that my teammates played had a positive win percentage against the white decks, but we kind of didn't play them. They were kind of at the top of the standings while I was kind of more in the middle. And so sometimes you get these weird pairings, and it's one of these circumstances that's hard to explain. I believe at this moment, for sure, white decks, that you should be gunning for them on the very top of your radar, but don't forget about everything else would be my take there.
So I had LSV's deck up on the screen. I had two more decks pulled up, John. One of them is Andrew's list that won the Pro Tour. That went, veteran Loxodon, I think is the name of the card. Both of those lists had that. One of them playing Rustwing Falcon over the Healer's Hawks and Subhorn Sentries, stuff like that. You know, there's so many different one drops that are seeing play, John. How do you decide which version that you would pick?
Okay, well, so you're starting from the point of you're good, this is the best deck and you're going to play it, and which version do you play?
We can start there. I think that this is the deck of the week, and that's what's important. Whether it's the best deck tomorrow, whether it's the best deck in 2 weeks, I think that that's easily up for debate. But it is a deck that we know people are going to gravitate towards across all levels of Magic due to its success on the Pro Tour.
Yeah. So I guess, so like Seth was saying, this deck, it's now had two very successful weeks because it did extremely well at the mocks. Although, like, if you said going to the PT, like if you look at the day one metagame from the PT, I will probably talk about that later. But black green was the most played deck. And I think that a big part of the success of White Weenie is probably based on a good black green matchup. And if people tomorrow are starting with this is the best deck, then you're going to see a very different metagame. And, you know, I played a completely different deck than Seth. I played mono red, and I also thought I had a good mono white matchup. And I didn't play against mono white. Obviously, I was doing badly in the tournament, but I played my five rounds and I didn't face mono white a single time. So if you're trying to pick, I don't think you can say what's the best version of mono white, because it's going to depend on what decks people pick up to try to beat it. Not so much what decks, like how you would, if you replayed the Pro Tour, the answer would be very different than what deck should you play tomorrow in an event. And I think the version you'll want to be playing tomorrow is a deck that can withstand the attack from the decks that prey upon mono white more so than, or, and also win the mirror more so than what's the objectively best version. So yeah, I would take that into consideration. I'm not really sure. Like I didn't test mono white for the PT. I played against it a bunch, but I'm not sure which version would come out on top against, you know, that with that in mind. It's definitely some things to work on.
All right. I'm impressed by you guys. I hope you guys know that. So with that being said, what if people want to pick up this deck? What are like the key cards and the key matchups outside of the mirror that they should be thinking about and the cards that they should be thinking about right now?
So, I mean, when I was watching the coverage of the, you know, a little bit on day two and in the top eight, like a card that really, so I think the key cards of the deck are, you know, History of Benalia, Adanto Vanguard. There's different supporting cast. I think Conclave Tribunal seemed very important. I would see games won or lost based purely on whether they could answer the one key threat, whether it was an Experimental Frenzy or, you know, just a key creature, a Teferi, whatever it was. Like this card seemed quite important. I guess those three. There's, I mean, like the Benelish Marshall's good, Venerated Loxodon's good. I don't know if every version played them. But yeah, those to me are the key cards.
Seth, you mentioned that you thought your team had a good White Weenie matchup. What decks were you guys playing?
So for this Pro Tour, I played Green-White Midrange, which was my own take on the deck. And if you want to hear more about that, I kind of did. There is the patron-only episode featuring my take on it. But I had three Lyras in the deck, which is possibly the single best way to combat the white decks, because those decks have to attack. They have to win by attacking you. And especially since my deck also had removal for Conclave Tribunals, like attacking through a Lyra Dawnbringer is a really tall order, even if you're able to buff up the creatures. So I also had Baffling Ends. I had some cheap removal and some ways to kind of sit behind my Lyra Dawnbringer if I get into play with my Planeswalkers. So that was kind of my take on the matchup. Only played against it one time at the Pro Tour, but I did beat it, and it was 2-0, so it felt pretty good. And my teammates did play Black Green. I think that a lot of the Black Green decks now are gearing more towards wild growth walkers and life gain and these big creatures along with Fine Finality. So I think it can be a tough matchup. It's pretty close, but it kind of depends what version of the white deck you're playing. As I mentioned earlier, I think that the CFB version has a few more smaller creatures. They don't have as many of the big payoffs. So if the Black Green deck can kind of get a wild growth walker going, it's pretty tough for that particular version to overcome that, I think. So yeah, it kind of depends what you're looking to beat. If you're looking to beat the mirror right now and play a white deck, maybe you go with the CFB version, but that's kind of making the gamble that people are going to stop playing Black Green, which I'm not really sure that, even though there was no copies of Golgari in the top eight of the Pro Tour, I still think it's a pretty popular deck. We've seen it kind of show up in big numbers at every major in-person tournament. So for me, I'm going to Milwaukee and I'm this weekend, which is the Grand Prix, and I'm still kind of expecting to see Golgari. So don't discount decks like Golgari, the Is It Phoenix deck, Jeskai Control, and Mono Red. Those are still decks that should be on your radar.
Well, let's actually transfer into the whole conversation about the Pro Tour for our training grounds, and let's actually talk about the metagame specifically. So I'm just going to throw out some day one numbers, and then we'll talk about the day one numbers really quick. There were 113 Golgari decks making up 22.2% of the meta. The red-white aggro decks, there were 81 of them. They made up 15.9% of the meta. Is It Drakes with 66 made up 12.9% of the meta. Mono Red with 64 decks made up 12.5% of the meta. And Jeskai Control with 56 made up 11% of the meta. You know what's crazy, too, is if you just switch white-red and Golgari places, though, that's the order in which they did the best at the Pro Tour also. So the one of the questions could be, John, is was it a self-fulfilling prophecy that these specific decks would do well because the players brought them the most in volume?
Okay, so I think the biggest thing, like when we did our patron only episode, I mean, you asked me what decks I expected, and I basically listed 8 decks, and these were the most played eight decks. So in that way, there were no real surprises in terms of archetype. And I think a big factor is, you know, the Pro Tour was 7 weeks after the release. There's been major tournaments. There's been some GPs, some SCGs, some the mocks that has sort of refined the metagame to the point where you need to be pretty confident that what you're doing is good to go off the beaten track. You know, Seth came up with this white green mid-range deck that, you know, wasn't really expected, and that's maybe a good idea, but I don't know if it was self-fulfilling. I think these are just the best, you know, archetypes with a card pool right now, and doesn't mean you can't do something else, but I think the surprises maybe were in the percentages as opposed to which decks people played.
Yeah, Seth, 22% for Golgari.
Yeah, I think that there were talking to a number of other pros, they were saying, oh, we were only expecting 10% Golgari. And I kind of made a face at that because it sounded like they must have been playing a lot online or looking at the Mox results in particular, rather than looking at the Grand Prix that had happened a couple weeks ago. I believe one of the European Grand Prix had 40% Golgari. So, and the deck did well. And so those same players are, what if they did well with Golgari, they're going to continue to play Golgari. They're not going to drop the deck. Like we saw Javier Dominguez, for instance, make top four of that Grand Prix. And then, of course, he brought Golgari again to the Pro Tour. That's just kind of a trend we're going to see. If a lot of players play a deck and they do well with it, they're probably just going to stick with it unless for some reason the deck is no longer good. But we're not seeing these cards in the metagame that are super one-sided. Like we'll see maybe Deafening Clarion is like one of the signature sweepers, but Jeskai has to play that card against white decks just to kind of have a chance. But there's no like one card you can put in your deck that you can just like completely shut down another deck. So you're really just kind of, like John mentioned, percentage points. You're kind of just trying to leverage that a little bit. Like, all right, I want to make my list 5% better against Golgari or 5% better against Is It Phoenix or white decks by changing a couple cards or a couple sideboard slots. That's kind of where we're at in the format because we are a few weeks into it. We know what the best decks are.
Did you expect Black Green to be the most played deck set?
At this weekend, or for the Pro Tour you're asking?
For the PT, yeah.
For me, it was, I thought probably, but it was that and the white decks kind of interchangeable. Okay.
Also, I noticed when I was looking at the data, they have red white aggro as the second most played deck, and they have Boros aggro with a significant percentage, about seventh on the list. So I don't know exactly what line they're choosing to separate those decks. I think it's like the white red mentor strategy more so in the Boros deck. But they both play probably pretty similarly, and that makes the percentages even closer if you add those two together.
Yeah. So I did on our data that I posted on the Patreon, I believe the total comes to 88 decks. Oh, no, okay. Because I'm not including Boros Aggro, which is another 18 decks. So that would put it at 106.
One card. So we're talking about specific cards that that could, you know, like Seth was saying, there's no single card that pushes one of these strategies out because the Jeskai deck already has to play Clarion. It's not a new card they're going to start playing just to beat up on white. I think one card that you could see move in and out of the metagame as a response is Lava Coil. Now, I don't think that's specifically the card you necessarily want to be mono red, but, you know, if the Crackling Drake deck gets a little more popular, that's kind of a metagame card that I played one copy in my main deck. I think the red decks could start playing more. So that's a card I keep an eye on. Certainly if the blue tempo deck gets popular, that's a great card.
And I think Seth even mentioned Lyra could be another card that sees an uptick in play just because it's good against, I mean, let's be honest, Lyra is good in basically every matchup. It's a must deal threat in every matchup. The only problem is it's like mana cost against control, but you need threats anyway. So,
well, yeah. I think it's probably bad against control. I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. It's like that's where it's at its worst.
Mm-hmm. Another card that I wanted to play at this Pro Tour, but I just never really got the right shell for it, is Settle the Wreckage, because it's a way to actually deal with the Adanto Vanguard. But the problem with Settle is you want to be playing it in a control deck. Like, sure, LSV, okay, we can talk about how he blew out his it blew out Dasani to win his semifinal match. That's a very memorable moment. But it was a one of in his sideboard. Right. So to put that in perspective, like, he's an aggressive deck. So he's not going to be like overloading on Settles, I don't think, in that deck is correct. But for a deck like maybe a slower white green deck, like I did have a Settle in my list, but I think that the best place for Settle is in control. The issue with putting it into control is the mana base right now, because blue-white control, there's only really Glacial Fortress as the premium blue-white land that you want to be playing, and then like you have to go to Meandering River and stuff like that, and there's disadvantages to just playing straight blue-white. I think that if there's a way to incorporate maybe some Settles into a Jeskai list or another type of control deck, maybe Esper, maybe blue-white, like for me that's a card that if you're able to kind of have other spells and have, like, in your deck, like, say, Chemist's Insight and Settle work really well together.
Right.
If you're able to start passing the turn and then have other things to do if you're not settling the opponent, like, that is one of the best sweepers that's still kind of in the format that I could see seeing more play. We saw very little of it at the Pro Tour.
One thing about Blue-Eye Control as well is one of the cards that really stood out to me at this Pro Tour was Niv-Mizzet. Like, that card was just way better than it had looked throughout its entire time in this format to me. And Seal Away is a card that I saw seeing play in some of the Jeskai lists that wasn't happening on MTGO. So that's another one that surprised me.
I have a couple of thoughts about, like, so I agree with Seth about Settle the Wreckage versus the white decks, but I think one thing that's keeping it out of play, or maybe relegating it to sideboards a little bit, is, so I played mono red, and for an aggressive deck, Settle is a card I was not afraid of at all. Thinning my deck, getting lands in play for Experimental Frenzy was very useful. I didn't care about, you know, my 2/1 that's already done 2 damage, or my one drop haste. Like, all of these are cards I didn't even really mind trading for a land at some point.
Right, and especially with Banefire, right?
Yeah, and Banefire as well. So the fact that it's maybe more narrow of a card than it used to be. Like, it used to be so good against, you know, Phoenixes and all these cards. I still think, like Seth was saying, it's a very powerful card and very good against the white decks. But I think that's the fact that it's not as versatile is maybe what's keeping it back a little.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think Spencer made a great point about Seal Away. Exile removal is good, but there's going to be downsides. Like, we're seeing, even within the past, like, day or so, I feel like Mono Red has been kind of ticking up in popularity. Like, I saw Ifro tweet out how great he thought Mono Red was, and some of the other pros were saying, oh, well, Mono Red is the answer to the white decks because it does have Chain Whirler, and Chain Whirler is a card that deals with, if you're trying to play Healer's Hawks and Leon and Vanguards and, you know, a bunch of one toughness creatures, Chain Whirler looks really good. And so far, Mono Red is really the only deck that has been able to capitalize on that card in this current format. So yeah, I think Settle the Wreckage, my main point there was not that it was good against red. I agree with John. It's got some downsides there, especially if you're settling and then they just drop an Experimental Frenzy and you don't have an answer to that. But against white decks in particular, out of control, I do think it is a pretty strong card.
Yeah.
One card I like that Seth, you were playing that I didn't see a lot of I guess when I was testing online, you saw it occasionally, but you had three Ixalan's Bindings.
Oh yeah. I love Ixalan's Binding in this format because it can actually be card advantage because you're often sticking your opponent with a card in their hand, especially against a deck like the Drake's deck, where they're going through so much of their library that if you get one Drake, like you may get a second one, and it's a flexible removal spell and it exiles. Anything that exiles, like for me, playing it in a deck that wasn't playing a lot of small creatures, or if they were, they were Llanowar Elves, it was a very easy decision to play all Ixalan's Bindings and no Conclave Tribunals, because I think the upside on it is definitely relevant.
Oh yeah.
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 One problem that you do have with it though, that just kind of a common play pattern. I played Jeskai Control today, and 5-0'd with it. And you guys are just basically validated everything that I thought about this format so far. And I had an Ixalan Binding in the main and won the board. And I Ixalan's Binding a Arclight Phoenix, thinking that's sweet, and then it was not as sweet as I was hoping. But that's somebody that they do come back. Everybody, they do still come back.
I've never won a game where my first frenzy got binding.
You've never. So. Oh, I don't think that Mono Red can win a game against a lot of decks that would be playing Ixalan's Binding if you're.
Well, I think it's good against Mono White.
If it gets a binding, I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Another card that actually surprised me at the PT. So it's a card I was thinking about because I played it in the previous standard a lot, and I thought it was like I'm talking about Karn. I played it in red black when nobody was playing it as another four. I liked having one or two Karns, and it was kind of off the radar before the PT, I thought, but I played against it a lot in my rounds. Seth, you played that card too, right?
Yeah, Karn is my favorite card in the format, so yeah. I definitely played it.
Didn't your black-green players also play Karn?
I mean, I saw it in Grixis. I saw it in a little bit in black-green. Like, I was surprised it was so off the radar before, but I was like, oh, maybe I'm missing something. But I guess I wasn't. Like, yeah, did you get to Karn later? Were you always on it?
Well, I played three Karns in my black-green list that I went 12-3 at the last Standard Grand Prix, and it was great for me with, like, I had Druids and Elves. It was just Golgari, and I was kind of telling my teammates, yeah, like, you should put Karn in your deck. It's just a good card, especially if you have ways to play it on turn three. It's really good. I believe my teammates ended up, like, with one Karn, but I wanted to go bigger because I just wanted to draw it. I wanted to make sure I drew it. Sure. And if my opponent killed the first one, I wanted to be able to, all right, just throw the second one down. And the great thing about Karn is that it just, like, for a mid-range deck where there's not really a bunch of card draw, but, like, the card advantage in this format is Explore, right? So, like, it allows you to go through so many cards in your deck. Like, I played a match against Jadeen Clamperin's where she was on Golgari, and I needed to find one of my Ixalan's Bindings to deal with her Vivian Reed that was going to go ultimate. And I went through like 10 or 12 cards with my Karn. And on the last uptick, it was on like 10 loyalty or something. I finally found it. And there would have been no other way for me to deal with that Vivian unless I had just been going up, 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 up with Karn just to be able to see all those cards. So I think it's a great way to get some card advantage. If you're able to defend it, it's a four mana play that it doesn't immediately take over the game, but it will take over the game if it just stays in play.
So the way that would typically happen, right, is you're taking it up for card advantage, and then eventually you just turn the corner by going like minus, 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 just grow team, right?
Yeah, it depends on the deck. I'm rarely actually making the creature with it because I would rather just be, like, normally I'll have better spells, and like going a 1-1 into 2-2s into 3-3s is kind of slow. Sure. And it's also a significant amount of loyalty that you're using. So okay. Since we're no longer in a format where you're playing Karn alongside a lot of artifacts, I'm normally only making the construct if I'm chump blocking, awesome. Which is, yeah, so not normally doing that.
Thank you. That's helpful. I'm excited because I'm about to, after this podcast, I'm going to put some Karns in some decks. So I'm excited for that.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one thing that I just want to wrap up is on the day two metagame, the highest conversion rates were pretty clear. So we have red white aggro, how it was classified with 69%, mono red with 67%, is it Drake's with 68%, and then I think the highest was Selesnya tokens with 76.9%. And then I think White Weenie was next, But Celestia midrange also in the 60s. So it looks like green decks actually did have a good conversion rate kind of throughout.
So a couple ones I mentioned at the end, there were very low percentages. So you might just have like a handful of players who did well, I think, like the white green tokens or the white weenie. I think if I'm looking at the stats now, I think like the big loser by far was the blue tempo deck, which had a conversion of 43.8%. I think that deck was just probably the worst choice of the main decks. And the other one that sort of, so you expect like the most played deck to have a middling conversion rate. So like, I'm not surprised black green is lower than some of these other decks, whereas decks that are maybe good against black green had higher ones. I think the Jeskai percentages, this is something I was talking to a few pros after the tournament. When you play a deck like Jeskai at the PT, like a deck with sweepers, with control elements, that's just trying to buy time. When you play that against very high caliber players, you don't get a lot of the free percentage points that you might get, you know, at a PPTQ or the early rounds of a GP, where, you know, they might overextend when they shouldn't. They might, you know, play the best spell into your counter spell and have no follow-up. But at the PT, people are going to play around settle. They're going to, you know, play around your sweepers when they can and also know when they can't. And I think that might be, I don't think Jeskai is a bad deck. I think Jeskai is a good deck, probably good against the white decks, but it had a bad conversion rate. And I think that might be part of the reason why.
I think it's interesting. Some of these stats, like there's variables that we can take something from the stats, but I don't think you should get too caught up on them. I do believe that the mono blue deck, like for me, it was a deck that I decided not to play, even though I liked it, because I didn't like the matchup against mono red or against Boros. But then you see, and you look at the conversion rate, but then you see someone go 10-0 at a Pro Right. Tour with that mono blue deck, and it's like, all right, like what the hell? Like, how do you, like, if the deck's bad, how do you go 10-0 when the, like, it's extremely difficult to go 10-0 at a Pro Tour. And there was two players that did it this time. But part of that would be sometimes you'll see those types of stats and then you'll be like, well, why isn't that player in top eight? Well, they were probably playing at lower tables. They probably had a very bad, poor draft record and that sort of thing. And sometimes you'll get into these situations where, like, at the top tables, it was all white decks somehow playing against each other. And then at the bottom tables, it was maybe more green or maybe something else. So kind of these wonky stats. I want to go back and retest these white decks to kind of figure them out. Like the Dazani deck to me looks on paper a little bit worse than the other decks, just from, at least for my play style, because it's more red based rather than the Benelish Marshall Luxedain version. And I feel like that may not be where I want to be, but I think that's kind of the conclusion that most of us are going to draw from looking at some of the Boros decks. I think Andrew's deck looks good. I think he went 8-2 with it in the Swiss rounds, and then in top eight it played out pretty smoothly. So that would kind of be the version that I feel like most players are going to stick with more so, but let's not count out some of the other variations of the deck. So I think one of the most interesting things to see within the next couple of weeks is going to be which version of these white decks players start to go towards.
Awesome. Well, let's wrap this up with a couple of just questions for you two. We'll start with you, John. What did you learn about Standard from this Pro Tour?
About the current Standard or Standard in general?
This Standard specifically.
Well, I think I learned a lot leading in the last couple of days leading up to the PT, and I mean my actual tournament was a little bit short. So I played the mono red deck, and I talked about this a little on Patreon too, is I wasn't super confident because I felt like matchups I sort of took for granted were worse than I thought. And the bad matchups, like normally in Standard you have very close matchups. Even the like a bad matchup, you might be like 40%. And I felt that I was losing more percentage than that against some of the black green decks. And it wasn't justifiable just to have like an advantage in a couple of matchups, to have these really bad matchups. And I think that's probably also where the blue tempo deck suffered. But yeah, I mean, I think this format, I expect it to be a bit of a cycle. I think the decks at the top will go through a bit of a rotation. Like it's easy to look at the results with six decks in the top eight, white aggro, whatever different versions, and say that that's the best deck. But black green was the most played deck. And if white's the most played deck, you might see a very different, you know, metagame percentage breakdown or conversion percentage. Different decks might rise to the top. I think that because there are a lot of good decks, and, you know, Wizards has been trying really hard to make sure that's the case, tuning your decks constantly is going to be important. You're not going to be able to pick up a 75 and say, I'm going to play this 75 all season. You need to adjust for what deck is currently popular, what deck people are going to show up with, what deck won last week. And I think that, yeah, so I think it's a healthy format. You know, that's what I learned. I think that they did a good job, even though they probably would have liked a few different archetypes in the top eight. I think that it is a good standard format.
Seth, what about you? What did you learn about standard from this Pro Tour?
Yep, I agree with John. I've been liking the format. I think that you can pick and choose to play any of the top archetypes or even one that's not one of the top decks and still do well, as long as it's a tuned version of a deck that you're comfortable with. And I'm happy that I may, you know, and I kind of prove that by playing a deck that a version of a deck that I don't think anyone else was playing at the Pro Tour. So kind of just trusting your gut with the deck decisions. The games themselves can be really grindy and long if you're playing a green midrange deck. So I was playing one and just kind of be prepared that you're not going to get these games that are ending on turns five or six, or they're going to be long and drawn out. So that kind of gives, if you're a player that is good with the green midrange decks and can leverage play skills and going through your deck, and lots of these decks go through a huge portion of their deck. Like, is it Arclight goes through a lot of the deck. So if you're not playing the aggro deck, the white deck, prepare to play long games. That would be where I'm at with the format.
John, I think, are we both playing Legacy in Vegas?
I'm playing Standard.
Oh, you're playing Standard. All right, so you're both playing Standard this coming weekend. So with that being said, you're jumping in the league after this podcast. What are you jumping in with, John?
I'm going to jump in with Seth's white green deck. for a number of reasons. I mean, I think a lot of the points he made, I really, you know, I like a lot of the cards he's playing. I think what he said about Lyra in particular is very interesting, and I think it's probably a very good way to start on, I want to play a white deck that beats the white decks. I'm going to try it. I think it's got potential for sure. And I think it survives the changes that come out of the Pro Tour. So that's where I would start.
Seth, you're jumping in a league. What are you jumping in with?
Well, I do kind of want to play my green-white deck again in a league. I will say that I like the deck a lot still, and I'm kind of have a couple questions with how I want to tune it. Like for last week for the Pro Tour, I had four Tecatli in the main, expecting a lot of Golgari. Clearly, I wouldn't have four Tecatli in my main deck if I wasn't expecting that. So I want to jump into a league to kind of get a feel for what's going on with the metagame, and I like to kind of fiddle around with control, possibly a Jeskai Drake deck with Deafening Clarion, because we kind of saw how great Clarion can be if you have a huge Drake in play already, because you can give your Drake's lifelink and sweep the board. So that's great if you're able to do both those things against the white aggro decks. And then another card I was mentioning earlier would be Settle the Wreckage, seeing kind of if that fits in a main deck somewhere in the format. Those are kind of the questions I'm looking to answer for this weekend.
Well, I was staying in an Airbnb with Greg Orange, who's, you know, he played Jeskai at the Pro Tour and basically only considered that a control deck for this PT. And he basically just said, you know, the Drake's deck is just a Jeskai deck without all the good cards. It's, it plays the same cards. He was playing four Crackling Drake, and he was, you know, Clarion gained seven life, and then he gets to play Teferi. So
yeah
the, I think that's
the I think the list I followed with today had four. It's either three or four Drakes in it too. So I would play green white in a league next. I have a list that I sent my friends to test for Vegas. That's based. It's kind of actually a mash between Seth's list and the list that took 10th at the Grand Prix overseas. And Seth and I actually talked about that list on the Patreon only episode. So I also would jump in with green. I think that I think you can build your green decks to beat the aggro decks in this format, and I like it when I can do that.
I think though, like, so I'm gonna, that would be, you asked me where I would start, but in terms of like a tournament next weekend, there's a few other decks I keep an eye on. I think like it's hard to do badly at a tournament with a deck and then run it back for the next tournament. But I think the red decks do still have potential, and maybe not right away, but if you keep an eye on the black green numbers, if those drop significantly, then I think mono red is actually fairly well positioned. So I wouldn't throw that out. Like Seth was saying, though, I don't think you can just give up on black green just because they didn't top eight or whatever. It's still going to be a popular deck. So for now, maybe put it aside. And I think also what I play next should be influenced by what questions I need answered.
Right.
And I think the biggest question right now is how are the white decks going to evolve? What version are they going to settle on? So maybe not what I would register tomorrow in a tournament, but in the next league, I probably want to play some of the white decks and figure that out.
Awesome. Well, that is it for this week. I'm really excited about the future of this, guys. This was really fun for me. So you can go to patreon.com/ccmtg to support the show directly. Our next Patreon goal is to get tokens made. I know that they took away Seth, your token at the Pro Tour, so I'm sorry about that. We'll have to get you a new one made. You can go to patreon.com/ccmtg, donate anything that you see fit. It's really appreciated. And then we can get some John and Seth tokens made and get those shipped out to our patrons. So do they give them to Gold Pros too, John? I thought it was just Platinums.
No, it's just Platinums.
Okay. Well, we'll get you a token anyway.
Yeah, I need one. Come on, guys. <I'm just
kidding>. Well, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, they there was a lot of uproar about the tokens and the shirts for this particular Pro Tour, but I think that, you know, while we lost our tokens and shirts, which was probably, you know, not a great move because it's a pretty low cost to have those, I think that I was very impressed with the overall numbers for the Pro Tour, viewing numbers, and the way that they incorporated pro players at the news desk and did some other things with them. So I think overall from this Pro Tour, I think that, like, I would give it a thumbs up to WotC. But yeah, that was kind of the one negative, was the pro player cards not being around.
I thought that the viewing experience dramatically improved for this Pro Tour too. So
I heard Eduardo was really good. I didn't actually watch that much of the coverage yet, but
yeah, Eduardo was good. And however, I have a new favorite duo, and I didn't know that it would feel this way, but Riley Knight and Paul Chion in the booth together is just a good time. I don't know why. Well, you can find me on Twitter at @SpencerH. You can find the podcast at @CCMTG, and I don't have my co-host Twitter handles memorized yet. Seth, where can I find you?
Well, if you don't have my name memorized yet, Spencer, I can give it to you. My name's Seth Manfield. That's my Twitter handle. So.
Oh, is that it?
So
is yours John Stern? It's not. It's John Stern something.
I think, it's, you know what? I might change it because I think John Stern is probably taken. It's John Stern MTL.
That's right.
Which is, I was living in Montreal. I'm not living in Montreal. And yeah, I don't want it to be confusing if people think, you know, John Stern MTG or something. So I'm going to think about it. But right now, at John Stern MTL.
Awesome. And then you can find the podcast every week on constructorcriticism.com, mtgcast.com. Yeah, and we really appreciate it. Hit that sub, that like button, hit that sub button. It means the world to us. You can join the conversation by joining the Constructive Criticism family on Facebook. If you're a patron of $12 or more, you can join the Constructive Critics group. You'll get access to things like deck lists when they're available. You get access to, questions for different segments on the show, different things that we're doing, and access to that community. You can also join the Discord. It's the Heezy Game Media Discord. You just go to the bios page at constructivecriticism.com that Spencer needs to update and join the Discord there. What did you learn this week, John?
Well, I learned, so going to this PT, I knew I would not have as much time as I usually do. And I still decided to stick to my guns and work on my own. Because I didn't want to pick up all the organizational work required to sort of work on a team. And I didn't want to jump into a team situation that wasn't really happy with. And I sort of realized like how much of a burden that is to sort of feel confident and be ready for PT when you're doing everything yourself. So I don't want to go into another PT thinking that I'm going to do badly. So I want to figure out exactly where I need to address specific issues, whether it's to get more metagame data or, you know, to have more of a sanity test, spend a little less time just on deck selection and more on tuning. So I need to improve that aspect. I need to figure out if I'm going to work alone, how I'm going to get this information, or if I'm not going to work alone, how I can coordinate with other people to get the information that I need and, you know, that they need to do well. So I learned the limitations of working on my own when I don't have as much time as I would like.
Seth, what did you learn this week?
Well, I learned that even though I thought I could juggle the Player of the Year playoff, the Hall of Fame, and testing for the Pro Tour with only a few days, it kind of hurt me actually at the tournament. I felt like because I was doing so much coordination for the Hall of Fame and then also thinking about a lot about what I was going to do for the Player of the Year playoff, it took away some of my time. It detracted from a little bit of my results. I felt like I could have maybe gone 11-5 at this Pro Tour with a bit, like if my play was a little bit better. And that's a big deal because one match win is 4 pro points and a chunk of cash. So I'm kind of leaving a little bit disappointed in myself. I feel like I left something on the table. For those who saw the match with Kai Bude, that was one of the really close matches. Could have gone either way. I had a couple of those that I ended up losing. And so those are the close matches that at a Pro Tour, in order to have a great result, you just have to win. And I wasn't able to do it. So I can blame myself. I can blame my testing process, or I can just... I'd rather not do that, though. I'd rather just blame the fact that I was put in the situation of having to prepare for 3 different things. So I'm just going to go with that for this one.
Well, thank you, everybody, so much for listening. We'll see you guys all next week. Magic, magic, magic.